Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texarkana.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey, for getting us on the show again tonight. It was pretty easy this evening. I think Blog Talk Radio has developed their technology to the point where you can almost do this in your sleep. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jumble Justice Radio Show and the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm Keith Haley, your host, and we want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that extensive trip across 90 different cities and states in the United States. And Emily and Mike, thank you for being in the studio tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is the same as it always is. We try to discuss news and issues and events and developments in the very interesting and sometimes difficult field of criminal justice practice. And we dedicate our show to these energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. What we try to do is look inside criminal justice practice and some of the things that affect us. And tonight will be a very good example. We're going to have a very interesting show. It's a second appearance for Dr. Jim Taylor, who's done some great work on the history of guns and gun rituals and symbolism. And we're really looking forward to that tonight. I guess it's been over a year since we talked to Dr. Taylor. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and as you watch and listen to that website over the past several months, you're seeing it continues to improve. It's now one of the top 100 websites in the world. They join sites like Google and iTunes and YouTube and MySpace. Simply remarkable in a matter of a little over 2 years that this has gone from one radio show on this network to literally thousands of shows, hundreds and hundreds of shows per week. And all of those shows are archived on the Blog Talk Radio Network for your listening pleasure or to use as you see fit. So get your own show if you have a need. Any organization, any group, any entity can have its own show and broadcast numerous hours a week and do that in streaming audio, broadcast worldwide, and it costs absolutely nothing. It's almost too much to believe. So you can call in tonight to our guest and ask questions and have a discussion at 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And should you miss the show tonight, of course, people can stay for the whole show. You can have it downloaded yourself within probably 10 minutes after the show is over tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm going to go ahead and click our guest on here tonight, if you folks don't mind, and have him join in on some of our preliminaries so we get started here.
Hello, sir.
How are you doing? We coming through loud and clear down to Zanesville, is that correct?
I can hear you just fine. It's a pleasure to be here with you this evening.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Tanner. Listen, I was browsing around your university website, and you're actually in Zanesville, is that correct?
I'm located permanently out of Zanesville now. That is correct.
Right. That is certainly a lovely venue to be teaching in, isn't it? Probably one of the prettiest parts of the state of Ohio. And
I believe.
A fond recollection of Zanesville, which I probably never told you. Back in, I think it was 1983 or 84, I had this crazy idea that I would like to run across the state of Ohio. And so a friend of mine who's a Dallas police officer, who also happens to be the Guns and Hoses, that's the police and fire heavyweight boxing champion for the state of Texas, we ran from Richmond, Indiana to Wheeling, West Virginia. And, of course, we were indeed happy to get to Zanesville because we were getting close to our destination. But we ran on Old Route 40, the Old National Trail, all the way across. It really a memorable event, and what a lovely part of the state of Ohio to be working in. And Jim, why don't you tell us what's your station in life there? What do you do?
What am I doing at the university specifically? I'm actually kind of a new acquisition at Zanesville. I've been teaching in the Ohio University system. I was in the Athens campus for the past 3 years, and I had actually had the opportunity to teach topics in criminology and sociology with him on and off since the winter of 97. So I've been around for a while. But my station in life, trying to turn my dissertation research on gun symbolism and gun rituals into my first book publication, but also juggle that with being a very proud father of two wonderful boys.
Well, that's great. How old are those boys?
My oldest son Graham is a year and eight months, and my son Charlie is only 7 months old.
Months old. Well, congratulations. That's certainly a blessing, isn't it, to have two of that age and two guys. So, well, good. Listen, one of the things that we do on the show, I think you recall the last time that I spoke with you on the show, Jim, was when I was on the Appalachian Trail. We did a remote broadcast. And right. Have Audrey, you know Audrey England, you've talked with her. Of course, she is from England herself, and she's a blonde. And she's always been a collector of blonde jokes since a little girl. She has the world's largest collection of blonde jokes. We always play a blonde joke, and I be sure to mention that Audrey is a blonde. So we're going to go ahead and play Audrey's blonde joke tonight so that we don't break tradition, and let's see what she has to say.
Looking forward to it.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke is another one involving a blonde with an automobile driving problem. They never seem to learn. Here it is. A police officer pulls over a car with a young blonde driver in it. The cop says, "Miss, this is a 65 miles per hour highway. Why are you going so slowly?" The blonde says, "Officer, saw a lot of signs saying 22, not 65. "Oh, miss, that's not the speed limit, that's the name of the highway we're on." The blonde replies, "Oh, stupid me. Thanks for letting me know. I will indeed be more careful from now on." At this point, the cop looks into the back seat of the car, where the passengers are shaking and are as white as ghosts. The cop inquires, "Excuse me, miss, what's wrong with your friends back there? They're shaking something awful." The blonde responds, "Oh, officer, we just got off of Highway 119.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. That's a keeper. Listen, apropos of our topic tonight, we always play the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, their public service announcement. So we'll go ahead and play that right now and hope that the gangbangers and the criminals in the streets of the state of Ohio and anywhere else that they're listening will be turning in their firearms. Here we go.
carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
All right. Very much, Ohio Coalition. And again, we hope people heed your message. Jim, I think one of the things I'm going to do tonight, if you don't mind, is probably just skip over some of our news stories and just go right to your topic since it's so interesting. Some of the ones I had to talk about are actually relative to firearms. Maybe we could start with this, that you've noticed here since the election, a lot of the media sources are doing stories. I know the New York Times had an article about how gun sales are up. And they're attributing this to the change of administration, thinking perhaps that there will be tighter controls on firearms and that kind of thing. Have you heard anything about that?
You know, actually, it's no big surprise. I have caught little blurbs about it here and there. It's actually started probably to pick up a week or two before the election. The sales were up in a lot of places, but there was actually a really important kind of a seminal research piece on the motivation for gun ownership that came out in 2001. I think it was in Social Sciences Quarterly, but it was an article written by Timothy John Curry and Robert Giabu. And it was on confidence in the U.S. government and how that relates to firearm purchasing. And in their article, they were using a really large data set. It was GSS with over 20,000 respondents or sample size. And they had said back in 2001 that they could demonstrate a relationship when people had low confidence or shaken confidence in government at the national level, firearm purchases would go up. So
Undergirding that, their motivation there is what? Their fear that, what, government's going to collapse, or what's the view there?
Their argument was that, now again, they're relying on GSS data, so they're not able to actually go back and ask people or re-ask questions themselves. They're having to go with questions that have been asked people just like regular census questions. People were saying on their GSS responses, that it was the aspect of confidence was their belief that they were not protected or likely to be protected in their own homes.
I see. Yeah, I think someone had mentioned in one of these commentaries, might have been public radio, I'm not sure, but something I heard on the radio where they were saying that they had heard that the new administration might be wanting to impose some type of training on purchasers of firearms, either before or immediately after they purchase the firearm in order to retain the thing, and people were worried about that. And I think one of the commentators on the New York Times article said that the best advancer of gun sales in a long time was President Clinton's election in the 1990s because they the same thing, and people went out and bought firearms. And I'll ask you this question. I don't know much about it, but I'm sure you would. Are we safe in saying that for most firearm purchases, the value of that weapon goes up over the years?
Did you say for most that they go up over the years? It depends on the type of the gun. Some categories of firearms do go up. You know, like, for instance, if you're going to go out and buy a nice decorative Winchester pump 12-gauge or 20-gauge, if those are well-maintained, they're going to go up. Certain categories of guns, as you know from your research, that cater to gun collectors that are definitely going to go up. Weapons that have actually been used in war. Unfortunately, the connections between guns and violence, which is the thing that turns off so many people in the general population, is actually what drives up the value of the weapon sometimes if they've actually been used in the commission of a crime. I think it was Pancho Villa's, a couple of his guns were auctioned off a little over a year ago. And the model and make of the rifle and pistol, neither one, if they had not been owned by Pancho Villa, they were only worth in the hundreds of dollars, which is still decent. But they auctioned for well over $30,000 apiece because of their association with his crime.
I never thought about that. That's interesting. So somebody got Al Capone's gun, or did he have one?
Well, Jack Ruby's gun auctioned off for well over $100,000.
Is that right? Oh, isn't that
something?
Yes, sir. Well, listen, Jim, why don't we just go ahead and get into how you started this whole thing. Again, a little bit of review. You told us more than a year ago, and then since that time you've since this thing and presented your dissertation and been awarded the doctoral degree. Congratulations. Certainly no mean task in life, is it?
No, glad to have that behind me, for sure. Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on your show before to talk through it and, you know, sort of work through some of the issues. It was a really broad project and not the kind that most advisors would recommend to someone getting into because it just takes so much time to gather the data. In my case, though, as you well know from articles that you've written, it's no secret. There are dozens of books out there telling you that, you know, there's probably somewhere in the ballpark of 200 million or more guns in working order in active circulation in the United States right now. Conservative estimates usually say it's pretty close to that amount. Some estimates would drive it up much higher than that. And usually the large national surveys will say there's somewhere around 40% of the U.S. population actively owning guns. So, you know, no big secret, we've probably got at least 100 million or more Americans actively armed at any given time. So, and given the fact that, you know, you've got 30,000 injuries, you know, gun-related injuries resulting in death, whether it's suicide or crime each year in the U.S., you know, we know that guns are related to violence, and we know that their presence is known. They're everywhere. They're referenced in song. You open your shows with Johnny Cash. And actually, a part of my research got into, I could have done a whole chapter just on Johnny Cash lyrics that mentioned guns in them, you know, in the songs, because there were so many. You had mentioned in research that you had done before how, you know, as part of doing the research, you become sensitized to how many gun references there are in popular culture out there. It's amazing. So I knew going into it, no big surprise, guns are a big part of our life. And whether you're pro or against guns, they're everywhere. And we know that they're associated with a certain amount of crime. But most of the scientific research that's been available and coming out in the past few decades only ask the questions of gun owners, a very generic, what do guns mean to you? And it's usually focusing on, they mean patriotism, they mean my Second Amendment right to bear arms, and of course the ever popular, they mean protection, you know, like the Curry-Giabu research. But my take on guns was, you got over 100 million people in the U.S. owning them. There's got to be way more reasons than those three. You know, there's got to be a lot more behind it. And we know that most of those guns aren't actually used for the commissions of crime. And a lot of them is a lower percent than I would have guessed. It's only 20-something percent that's actually used actively for hunting and sport. So I was wondering, what's going on with these millions of guns not being used for crimes, not being used for sport or hunting? You know, why do these people actually have them? And if we want to actually get our hands wrapped around issues with guns and come up with some good policy, I thought we needed a little better research getting into the symbolisms of guns. What do they really mean to people? And instead of just broadly, what do individual guns mean to people? Just because a person has guns, let's say you have five guns, do they all mean the exact same thing to you? And part of my hypothesis was that the way that guns are going to come to be used is going to partly depend on the history of the gun. So I wanted to actually explore the living histories of guns and see if that influences the way that they're used in interaction. And so that's sort of how it all began. And it took about 3 years to pull it all together, but I finally came up with at least enough chapters to turn into a book or a dissertation. But I came up with some... I'm not sure exactly what area you would want to go into first, but I came upon some interesting patterns related to gun owners, gun collectors, gun enthusiasts that I documented that had not really been explored before. One of them being rituals surrounding gun use. There were notable categories of rituals that I noticed that I think actually might be important when we actually start coming up with some future policy. Since we had this landmark Supreme Court decision in June pertaining to the Second Amendment, the DC handgun case, guns have sort of become a more relevant topic again. Policy initiatives have changed a little bit, but it definitely says that the guns are still with us for now. It's something that we have to deal with their presence. So I think that this line of research actually gives us a new innovative way to think about dealing with the guns, but by exploring their histories and what they actually mean to gun owners.
You mentioned people have different reasons, and I'm thinking of the, hope I'm not inviting a burglar here, but the very small collection I have, which is actually four, and each one of them I have for a different purpose. It's interesting. One of them is just sort of a symbolic thing relative to some writing I did, sort of a feature type of firearm, and you probably see lots of examples of that. The other one was just sort of a thing that was so small I thought it was cute. It was almost, and then the other, you know, was more of a protection type of weapon. Then another one was one that was going out of date over the
right.
years. But I put that, and I've had that for a long time, but I bet you've got two oodles of examples of those kind of things. So go ahead. By the way, did you listen to the D.C. versus Heller case? Were you ever hear any of that testimony? Able to?
I actually only I've read excerpts from it. I never actually heard any of the live testimony.
Well, I love this website for teaching, but if you go to oyez.org and actually hear all those Supreme Court cases and not only you hear it, you hear the testimony and the justices asking lawyers questions, but it scrolls in front of you, the text, the later
right.
ones, and you see the picture of the justice asking. There was a funny part in there about one of the justices asking, well, let me see if I have this right now. Somebody breaks into my house, you know, downstairs, and I have to turn on the light, put on my reading glasses, get my combination lock, and unlock my firearm, and then assemble it, and then I'm ready to do it. The whole court cracks up.
That's one of the excerpts I'm familiar with, and I actually had sort of a bone to pick with the Supremes on when they decided to make a ruling on this case. They waited over 150 years to interpret the Second Amendment. And I had actually completely finished my dissertation. I had it approved by my committee, and I had this section in there talking about how this landmark case was about to be decided by the Supreme Court sometime in the summer, and my defense was scheduled for in the summer. And they actually they ruled on it within just a couple of days before I had to do my defense. So, I was so excited. I had everything finished and approved, and then I had to actually go back and add what their decision was and what the ramifications were. So. It's like I was being picked on by them,
Well, tell us about some ritual. About what do you mean by that?
About the rituals, you think?
Or the symbolism. What? Tell us more about. Tell us as you can about your dissertation, if possible.
All right. Well, I wanted to know as much as I could about. Basically, I was lucky enough. Going around to over 20 gun shows in Ohio and Texas, and also going to the indoor shooting arenas and also to outdoor shooting tournament events. I was able to get 52 people out of talking to well over 100. I had 52 people that were willing to actually take the time to tell me what separate individual guns that they owned meant to them. So they would list the guns they own. They would put them in rank order of preference, which ones they valued the most. And then essentially I asked them to tell me in their own words why you value them. What is it specifically that you value about these guns? And it almost always resulted in a story. The ones that they valued the most, it was rarely the ones that cost the most. It was usually the story behind it, something funny behind it, a memory. But I noticed really early on, it was a highly emotional topic. There was a lot of emotion involved, and a lot of the collectors and owners, enthusiasts that I was talking to were people that in their normal lives would not show a whole lot of emotion. You know, they were pretty masculine characters, and they would do whatever was necessary to suppress most emotion, but not with their guns. And the way it sort of unfolded, every time I would go back, I would take notes about specifically what I observed and the patterns that I started to notice, the different types of emotions. I started to put them in different categories, which ones that I would see over and over again. And I started to think of it as rituals, and I was familiar with the work that Irving Goffman had done on interaction rituals. And for those listeners that don't have a background in sociology, I can give you the Reader's Digest version. Ralph Turner, a famous sociologist, and also Irving Goffman, a famous two different types of sociologists. One, very hardcore, hard scientific approach, or positivist, and the other, a social constructionist guy. And they both believed in their research that. Pardon me, it's cutting out for a second. You still hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. They had both argued that whenever we interact with one another as a species, and they would talk about humans as our current level of social evolution, the people that we have come to be now, they say in our current state, we don't have the ability in us just to interact with one another without having some kind of rituals. We have to have an introduction. Well, you know, whether it's humor or formality, and there has to be something in the middle, like a referee keeping conversations and interactions going, kind of policing us. That well, anyway, they both argued that this was the case, and I felt like I was actually seeing bits and pieces of this among gun owners. And Goffman had called them deference and demeanor-based rituals. He said that you could tell if we were performing rituals because there would be the deference that you paid to something or somebody. He would show us the amount of respect that you believe was deserved, but also by your demeanor, you know, how you actually acted towards these things. And I actually saw people showing deference to their guns over and over again and in a variety of different ways. And I started just chronicling those, and I was really surprised the way, literally, that people interacted with their guns. And from the lowliest, trying to think of exactly how to describe them, but take the gun shows, for instance, the gun brokers, the ones that were selling the cheapest guns. A lot of times, some of the brokers or vendors at the gun shows will refer to them as junk brokers because they're selling cheap guns, cheap pistols, cheap knives. They would show a high level of deference and demeanor to guns when they were handling them. Now, these are unloaded guns. You know, any of the gun shows, they're handled with a great deal of care. But the amount of respect that's being shown informally, you know, if someone was handing you a gun to see it, before they would tell you anything about it, they're typically holding it with two hands, caressing it almost, or holding it almost like you would a baby. But they're not usually holding them casually or cavalierly. It's a great deal of respect, and they also have a tendency to talk about them in the first person, like you're talking to an individual. But that was one of the surprises. I wasn't expecting to find that. I never really thought about guns in that way, that they were something, a symbol in our society that we treated so differently. And some of the patterns that I noticed, though, are specific rituals. There were retiring of the guns. You would hear people talk about how they would formally retire some of the guns that they owned. They were rewarding the guns, not themselves, but they would reward the guns for loyal and faithful service. Basically retire. I'm sorry.
Were they hunting weapons or what? They hunted for them for a while.
Yeah, it could tip it, or just guns that they had shot well, guns that they would say had performed well. And a lot of times they would talk about the guns like they were working as a team or a unit. And they wouldn't take all the credit for themselves as you know, having this great shot. It was, you know, the gun, the capabilities of the weapon. And they would refer back to they would want to retire the gun while it was still in good working order, still performing well. So you mentioned hunting, and there was a tendency for a lot of the collectors that were also hunters, or they also participated in target shoots, to retire the gun and literally have kind of an informal ceremony, sometimes a formal ceremony, after a good kill or after a good showing in a tournament. The retiring thing was pretty common. The naming of the gun among a lot of the owners and collectors was a common pattern. And a lot of the I'd say it was about 20% of the major collectors had names for at least some of their guns. But it was only ever a gun that they cared about, that they actually expressed some emotion towards. And, you know, a lot of times it would be sidekick names, you know, like Pancho and Cisco type thing. Some of the names that they would give them would just be funny. There was a one of the collectors had a Hawking muzzle-loaded rifle that he had named Rowdy Yates because he was a big Rawhide and Clint Eastwood fan. And he said the gun, to quote him exactly, he told me that he loved Western, specifically Rawhide, but he said Rowdy Yates was a bad mother effer. He said Clint Eastwood was the coolest cowboy ever. So, but he said the gun was so damn loud that Rowdy just seemed to fit. There was an interesting gun broker in Berea, Ohio, that had 1780s and 1720s models of the blunderbuss muzzle loaders, the kind of guns that you see like in the old pirate type movies, you know, where the guys are holding them from the hip and shooting. They look like the big muzzle guns, but kind of like maybe if they were sawed down. And he had two of them, and he had named one of them B. Arthur and the other Hillary Clinton. And he told me that the one that was a 1780s model, he named it B. Arthur because it was just a little bit bigger, more intimidating than most of the type. And he added that it was also old and ugly. And he said the one he named Hillary Clinton, it was because that model was to be shot from the hip. But he also said it was a loud bitch that's always shooting off at the mouth. So...
the 52.
What's that? I'm sorry.
The 52 people that you interviewed, were any of those women?
Yes, of the 52. I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, but also I looked at the data set. But let's see, right at 12 to 15% of the total were females, but. The problem with the women in the group, it wasn't that they weren't represented. I was actually surprised to find out how many that I met. Their collections didn't tend to be very large. All of them none of them in my group had actually intended to be a gun collector. It was a case where a grandfather or father had left them guns because they had no sons to leave them to, and they sort of begrudgingly got into it and then found out that they really liked it.
Interesting.
But I did notice that there was a little bit of a difference though from this emotion thing that I was talking about. Among the males that were talking about their guns, it seemed like it gave them an opportunity to express emotions that they normally couldn't, especially when they were telling stories about childhood and events that they had gone through with their fathers and with their grandfathers. I mean, these gentlemen would sit holding and cleaning, gently caressing these guns, telling me these stories about, you know, their first hunting experience. A couple of them told me some, you know, very detailed, intimate stories about how their one was a father and one was a grandfather, but in both cases their health was in decline, and just telling me stories about how they would actually just like to sit and clean the guns in private. It was like traveling back in time to when their father or grandfather were in better health and at their best. Had a great deal of emotional energy tied up in these guns. And in the case of the women, since the women collectors that I had interviewed, they weren't actually actively involved with it when they were kids and going through all the hunting and sport shooting. It came later in life. It just didn't seem to be quite the same thing or quite the same ritual.
But the men sort of liked this private experience because it allowed them to reminisce about the parents or the grandparents or whatever, huh?
I called it an emotional playground, a permissible playground, absolutely. They took advantage to sort of say things that they wished that they could have said, or, you know, directly to these other men, but they say it to the gun or about the gun instead. And I called that a kind of a cathexis-based ritual because they had so much emotional energy tied up in these guns. And these men didn't think of these guns as weapons typically either. I mean, they talked about them like they were a friend or a member of the family. And their reaction typically was one of offense, just to think about misusing one of these guns, you know, or not using it safely. just the amount of contempt and disdain that they had for people who would not use a gun correctly was pretty striking.
Probably see the same thing. You as a sociologist would probably see the same thing in collectors of other items, I suppose, race cars and perhaps motorcycles and things like that. You might see some of the same things, I guess, huh?
I would think anything that we had tied a great deal of masculine capital up in, you know, something that we've associated with men being men, absolutely. There is one difference, though, that I noted in my research. Now the rituals that I mentioned, you know, I noticed things like they celebrate the gun. You know, you could say you celebrate anything you collect. You could have presenting rituals. I had noted a ritual of talking up the guns. You know, they like to tell stories about, you know, like buddy stories. Me and my gun did this together. The naming of the gun, the retiring of the gun. But the one thing that seems to separate guns from other things that somebody would collect is the stigma that's associated with it. You have such a divided nation on whether you agree or disagree even with the right to own them.
Mm-hmm.
And with your gun collectors, they know they're a stigmatized group. I mean, you can go out and collect golf clubs or seashells or race cars or whatever. You're not making people sick, or they're not rioting or holding up picket signs for you, collecting those items. But with the guns, the collectors are reacting to this. I had just an absolute difficult time getting people to trust me enough to share the stories of their guns, because everybody thought I was coming to take their guns away without knowing anything else about me. They're saying, you know, aha, researcher, sociologist, you know, you're a liberal scumbag coming to disarm me. And it took forever to build up that kind of trust, so they would, and in some cases they were inviting me into their homes, showing me their collection, telling me these intimate stories of their lives. So, you know, that's the reason why it took 3 years to collect this information. But
when did you join the ATF?
Yeah, right. I'm glad that I had been on the show previously, because there was one gentleman that I had hounded for quite some time, major collector. He's actually written an article for the Ohio Gun Collectors Association, and he had refused to talk to me, didn't want to talk to me, and actually he wrote to me the first time and said, you know, he was very open. I didn't even want to respond to your email, you know, or calls at first, because I didn't trust you. But he found the transcript from the first radio show, and he listened to it and decided I was on the up and up. collected some great stories, and he had over 500 guns, so he had a lot of stories to share.
People have that many firearms. Are they stored like in one place?
Actually, I can't say about all of them, of course, but his were not. But he actually was someone I use as an example of the presentation ritual, because most of his were actually crated in some sort of a warehouse-type facilities or a large gun vault.
Uh-huh.
But the ones that he really loved, the ones that he highly valued, they were out on display, you know, in fancy display cases. And my collectors pointed out to me, it's not just a matter even of whether or not you've got a gun out on display for people to see. There's a pecking order. You know, you have some that are in a position of prominence because you want people to notice it. You want to tell people stories about it. And in a lot of cases, you want people to notice it so they can ask you about it and you can talk up your father or your grandfather, but again, through the gun itself.
It's kind of synonymous to people showing jewelry. As you happen to notice my watch or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very fascinated, though, with going beyond the reaction of gun owners, collectors, and enthusiasts, knowing that they're stigmatized for being a gun owner. But they've come up with these stigma management strategies to deal with it, ways to diffuse the situation so you don't think that they're the next freak in your neighborhood that's going to start a militia or something. And that was the typical way that upon meeting, you know, introducing myself, if I got a major collector or gun owner enthusiast to talk to me, that was the first thing they wanted me to know about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry about me. I'm not one of those freaks that you're hearing about on TV. I don't want to start a militia. It's the other guy that you've got to worry about. It's not me. that separates your gun owner from your average collector. But also, that thing that we were talking about earlier, a lot of times the value that's placed on guns by the owner has to do with the horrible things that the guns have done. The war collectors, for instance, a lot of times will place value in on a firearm, even though if it's typically a worthless piece of junk. And I believe it was the Nambu 8mm pistol, the Japanese pistol, typically only worth a few hundred dollars. They're notorious about misfiring. But I interviewed a major war collector, and even though he had guns in his collection that were worth, one was worth close to $10,000, his most prized possession was one only worth a few hundred because of the history of the gun. It was documented as having come from battle. It was actually taken off of a killed soldier in combat, and it put him closer to the battlefield, in his own words. So he valued it more highly for that reason.
Boy, is there anything you could say about or any commonalities about passion these primarily men here? I mean, what walks of life do they come from? All walks of life?
I'm sorry, you're asking about the demographics or backgrounds from the collectors?
Yes, uh-huh.
I was really surprised to find out how diverse the group was. I knew from some of the earlier research it wasn't just Southerners, you know, Southern hunters that own the guns. But especially when you start to get into the higher-end guns, the more valuable guns, and start looking at the people who own like the largest collection of guns, you start to get a far more diverse population in terms of it crosses racial boundaries, it crosses class boundaries, education boundaries. It changes from you being more likely to be from a southern climate and from a hunting family with lower education to middle to upper middle class, basically from anywhere, with higher levels of education, steady employment. And the church affiliation changes. If you just look at the statistics that talk about your likelihood of being a gun owner, it'll tell you that being a Protestant is a good predictor. You're more likely to own a firearm or have a household with a firearm if you're Protestant. If you look at the major collectors, that statistic washes out. There doesn't really seem to be a religious tie.
And at some point in time, this is an expensive enterprise for people, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're talking of that was another reason why a lot of your major gun owners and collectors are reluctant to talk to you. As you mentioned, even with just having a few guns, they are valuable. In the gun world, a gun that costs a few hundred dollars is almost a worthless gun. You know, they're more interested in the ones that are several hundred dollars or well into the thousands. But yeah, you're right. You start talking to several of the people in my study. They had anywhere from 50 to 500 guns, and it's a security risk. Even though you might say you have one or two of those guns for insured security, they all recognize that having them is also a security risk.
Did you happen to be able to identify, out of all the ones that you looked at, one that was like the most expensive, the rarest of all?
The rarest gun that I saw? I'm trying to remember. The single rarest, it was a Russian, I probably mispronounced it, Nagant, N-A-G-A-N-T.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a 1941 World War II M1 Garand and also M1 Carbine that were supposed to be really rare. Those are worth a great deal that I came around. It's several thousand dollars. I'm trying to... If you give me just a moment, I can actually get through. Where was that? The Russian Nagant pistol that was so rare and valuable, it was actually issued to Russian political officers almost solely for the purpose of assassinations in the field from anyone that tried to retreat during combat. But,
wow.
It was a very rare weapon, and the collector had said, I was actually told by multiple collectors that it was definitely a bragging rights type of weapon, even among collectors. It was the kind of thing that they said, if you've got one of those, you've got everything. in your collection.
A little bit of envy between them?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the bragging rights ritual, that wasn't that huge of a surprise that there was some of that going on, but instead of directly bragging on themselves, again, you get a chance to brag through the gun. Maybe inappropriate. Everyone thinks you're disgusting if you just stand around talking about how great you are. But instead, you can talk up this gun that you own. Yeah, it was specifically it was a Russian Nagant M1895 KGB model for the serious gun collectors that might be listening.
What's that worth, you think?
I'm trying to remember if he estimated. I don't believe anyone ever said a specific dollar amount. It was just the one gun that whenever it was mentioned, all the collectors would say, yeah, that's definitely rare. That's one that's worth bragging about. But it was over $10,000 anyway, the value of this particular piece.
I was speaking with someone today about this at lunch, and we were talking about are people who are licensed, federal licensed firearms dealers, and some of these people operate on their own at gun shows and other places and things, their homes. Are people making money?
Are they making money?
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's an incredible enterprise. Actually, selling the guns or even the ammunition for the guns, either one. Partially because the value of the gun can be based on so many different things, but the resale is incredible. You'll have the gun dealers, their brokers, buying a gun and doing a 300 to 500% markup often, and that was what I would find anyway when I would at the variety of gun shows that they would say that was typical of the markup. I mean, if you're making a profit of 300 to 500% selling used wares of any kind, you're probably doing okay, especially since sales have been pretty consistently high since 9/11.
I spoke with someone this past week about shopping in Dallas, your home state there, Texas, and he said he was in three stores on a Saturday, and one of those he spent about an hour in there, and he counted about 28 people that came in there and bought firearms in an hour and left.
Wow.
I didn't know you could fast, but I guess there were a lot of clerks working in the store. I don't know which one that was, but the business just booming. And
there's a really large event that's actually carried. Can't remember if it was out of the Fort Worth Stockyards or Reunion Arena, somewhere around in there. There's a really large event that I didn't get to attend. That I heard they were moving firearms faster than that. One of the big annual gun shows. But I'd actually attended one in January of last year in Tyler, Texas, at the Oil Palace there, which is a pretty large facility. And they were moving them in and out pretty quick, too. And there were well over 5,000 people in attendance for that event.
When we did our little study of the seven shows there, and six in Texas and one in Oklahoma, I was just astounded at the one at the Dallas
Convention Center.
I was just, the number of people and guns are just astounded. I would have never believed it.
Well, the very first gun show that I attended when I started this project was actually operated. It was a PRO, People's Rights Organization, gun show. And actually, for the listeners that are familiar with them, I know that they've had a little problem with their press lately from one of their members getting caught up in some illegal activities. But they're still the second largest Second Amendment advocacy group in the U.S., second only to NRA. And since they're based out of Columbus, they had lots of events in the Midwest. They were easy to find. But the very first one of their shows that I attended, it was actually at Eastland Mall in Columbus, Ohio, actually, in the city. And I went the second day of the event, late in the afternoon before close on a Sunday afternoon, and it was a rainy day, cold outside. And I was thinking, you know, there's hardly going to be anyone here, and I didn't really know what to expect in terms of the size of the event. And even at the end of the event, when things had slowed down, I counted close to 400 people there on that day. So there's plenty of business for these shows.
I talked to some of the you know, the promoters of those shows in Dallas, and they were saying that in a weekend it was not unusual for over 100,000 people to attend these events. I mean, just remarkable. One of the things I was going to ask you, were there cases, I guess, by the way, did you record these interviews or did you just take notes?
I'm glad that you asked that, because that's actually for any researchers or aspiring researchers that are listening. Now, this is such a sensitive topic. I had trouble just getting people to talk to me. You know, at first they were wanting me to tell a hike, you know. This again, the reaction to anyone wanting to talk about the guns, you're a sociologist, you're a researcher, you must be one of the bad guys. And I had a hard time getting beyond that. And part of it hurt my ego, because I always, you know, everyone thinks they're a nice guy, good sense of humor, easy to talk to. But it wasn't helping me a whole lot when I was getting started. And, I had gotten the people to agree to allow me to do tape recordings or audio recordings of the interviews. Because their stories were so long and detailed a lot of times, it was just easier than trying to write it down and then keep stopping them, you know, to catch up. But the problem was I interviewed some great storytellers. I mean, just wonderful, colorful people. And I noticed that whenever I would start hitting that record button, that they would start drying up, people that had been so forthcoming, wanting to share these great details. You know, I was so excited I finally got them to talk to me about stuff. But then when I hit that record button, they would just clam up and kind of start giving me short, choppy, you know, one- to two-word answers for things. So I only used them for a couple of interviews, and then I dropped it all together because I thought it was hurting the quality.
I think you're probably right. I've done a lot of oral histories, and you got to sort of prep people for that to let them know what's going on, what you're going to do.
Well, before I do it again, I'll have to talk to you because I was apparently lousy at it, and I ended up spending a whole lot more time and having to go back and have stories retold to get the details right sometimes. What I did get, though, was on the larger collections, I did get photo histories of some of the better collections. When they allowed me to come into their homes, I was actually able to take pictures of their guns. So I have photos of the guns and the details to go along with the history.
Wow. What kind of book is that going to be, Jim? That's going to be great.
Well, I think so. It's naturally I had to carve some of the things out, some of the theoretical development to make it more of an all-purpose general book that's useful to everybody. But the section on the gun rituals I think would be interesting and informative to just about anybody that hears anything about what's going on with firearms in the world, specifically in the U.S. But, I mean, these are real stories from real people, you know, things that they really care passionately about. And I think there's something there for just about anybody that's willing to give it a chance.
Let me try some superlative thing here. What's the saddest story you heard? Can you recall anything in particular?
I think personally the saddest came from a section that I actually called gun cleaning rituals, the private ritual. Because I had noticed that after about interview number three or four, while they were talking about their guns, they were cleaning them as they were going along. And I also noticed at the shooting tournaments that the shooters typically would go to these painstaking efforts to really clean these guns. But while I was talking to them, you know, they would be using these cleaning patches or cleaning them while we were talking. And I think it was just a couple of the different stories where the gentleman that I'd mentioned before, where they actually were kind of tearing up when they were telling the stories, because they were just reliving great hunting stories that they had with the gun many years before. In one case, it was with a grandfather that had Alzheimer's, and his grandfather couldn't remember the details anymore. So it was kind of killing the guy to think about it, you know, that he could remember them, but his grandfather, the memories were gone. And, he was kind of telling me, now, you know, me and the gun, we're the keeper of the memories for my grandfather, too. And there's just no way not to hear that and not get choked up, and especially when you're there seeing the emotion and the expressions in his face. It obviously meant a great deal to him. But I liked the way that he had phrased it. He and another one of the gentlemen, they actually talked about taking their guns out and holding them or cleaning them. They really did think of them as kind of like a way of traveling back in time and reliving these experiences with their relatives that I would imagine they couldn't enjoy.
I would imagine it would not be unusual in that group, in Persian's men here, that there are probably some people there that sleep with their guns, right?
One of the law enforcement officers that I interviewed actually took one of the pieces directly out from under one of his pillows when he was telling me the story about it. It was a gun. I'm trying to remember the... I have it somewhere in my notes. It didn't actually make it into the final cut of the paper, but it was whatever he actually used for a backup. He actually kept that under his pillow, one of his pillows.
I think going to be a coffee book, coffee table book also, don't you think? How many pictures do you have?
Oh, goodness. I'm trying to... In the version that actually made the final dissertation, it was about 217 pages and maybe 20 photos actually made it into that. But I've got well over 100 photos that were collected. And
Go ahead. What's the oddest thing you found in the whole study? Most unexpected. What's that?
The oddest thing that I found. I think I was really surprised by the formal retiring rituals, how many people were actually involved in that. They had a gun that they retired, and usually it was only a temporary retirement. They had retired it while it was still in good working condition, you know, until that next generation was ready to receive it. But as part of that retiring ritual, the oddest thing has to be the people that will make a trophy or presenting case out of the last kill that they had with the gun. So you'll see like a gun rack that's actually made out of the front legs and the part of the rack of the deer. I saw a few cases where they had turned that into the resting place for the gun in retirement, and one of them actually had a plaque fashioned on the front commemorating the date of the retirement that was engraved in the plaque.
Had any of those people ever had been the victims of theft, grand theft, that they mentioned?
There were a couple that had been victims of violent crimes. I don't remember theft being specifically, but there were a couple of people that had been involved in actually shootings. One of the gentlemen that collected guns, his son had been shot. He was still a collector. Actually, his son was shot at the home of a friend. They were looking at guns, and his son was shot, nearly killed, and had several feet of intestines removed. And he still stuck to his guns, you know, and said it wasn't the guns, it was the poor management of the guns, it was the lack of safety in the household.
Yeah, I've heard stories like that myself. Well, Jim, we're just about out of time, and I'm just absolutely thrilled about your project. And like I said, if I can't get buy the first copy of that book, I'm going to buy one of the very early ones, and you let me know as soon as possible when that comes up. And congratulations on a fantastic piece of research. I assume your dissertation committee liked this, didn't they?
Well, I'm very happy to say that I was given absolutely no edits. It was accepted as is. So
great.
They liked it enough.
I have a friend that's going through about the fifth edit, who happens to be from Dallas, and he's going to present in a few days, actually. So it's been a long road for him, and much of it wasn't his fault either. So,
well,
you know what?
Keeping with tonight's topic, you know, tell him to stick to his guns. I'm sure he'll come through it just fine.
Yeah, but it's top, so he has some, but. I want to thank you for joining us, and just let me know if we can do anything for you after this way. And on that other connection we have, we're working our best on that, so we'll let you know. So,
all right. Well, it's a pleasure, and I learn something new every time I talk to you. I'd never heard about your run across the three states. That's pretty impressive.
All right. Good night, Jim. We'll have
better
science. We'll be meeting again. Thanks again, ladies
right.
and gentlemen, for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
We meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long.